Here's how it began. Derek's audio reports.
Hello, Erica, and WVIA listeners of Northeast Pennsylvania. This is Derek Jolly, and I am recording a little bit of my thoughts and experience here. I am in the Alaskan Arctic Circle at Tulik Field Station, and it is a beautiful day. I have been blessed with beautiful sunlight. Snow had fallen last night on the Arctic tundra. It's so beautiful to still see how the snow has dotted the landscape as it melts. I'm looking right now at a small Arctic ground squirrel, also called a siksik. And this little guy is looking at me. The wind is cold. I can hear the drips of the melting snow off of the side of this trailer, this semi-permanent trailer in which we all eat our meals together. The season is winding down up here. There's only about 60 people on site, which is a relatively small community. At the peak season, there could be as many as 140. But the beauty of Tulik Lake, this Arctic lake, is breathtaking. I'm watching as the water trickles in and enters from the inlet. I also hear the sound of heavy machinery, which you may be able to hear. There is a project going on here. A large water storage tank broke, and they needed to excavate a good amount of the pad being the large earthen and stone surface, the flat surface here that the field station has been constructed on since 1975. They dug it up, finding several artifacts of the scientists that have spent their seasons here through the years, for almost 50 years now. Next year will be the 50th anniversary of this field station, and the research on the phenology or study of seasonal changes of the plants that we study up here, specifically a tundra sedge, a grass-like plant called cotton grass. Its scientific name is Areophrum vaginatum. Has been studied up here for just about as long as the field station has been established. They drove up here in 1975 to reconnoiter Tulik Lake, and crazy scientists like myself have been coming here ever since.
What's the meaning of a meaningful life? We all keep talking and no one's listening. What's the meaning of a meaningful life? We all keep marching to the beat of the same drum.
What's the meaning of a meaningful life? Derek Jolly asking that. We heard his report from August 2024 at the Arctic Circle. Young, adventurous, always curious, ever compassionate, Derek Jolly returned to the Arctic Circle to join researchers as they continued to study the sedges and conditions in the far north as the global climate continues to change. Derek is a native of northeastern Pennsylvania who holds a Master of Science degree in organizational development from the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine and a Bachelor of Arts in Psychology and History with music and WGS minors at Wilkes University. He's been coordinator of laboratory resources, clinical research, and hematopathology in the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at the Perelman School of Medicine at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania as well. Derek is also a musician who created the bands Cuddle Drug and Ticket to Ride. This is his tune titled Purpose. When Ken Burns and his team released their Leonardo da Vinci documentary in November of 2024, PBS awarded community service grants to stations like WVIA to produce programming highlighting STEAM projects within their respective coverage areas, science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics. We invited Derek in for an art scene interview to talk about the ways in which he brings together the arts and sciences in his own life. That's when he talked about his journey to Alaska and how he'd be taking his music with him. Right then and there, we invited him to send us some audio diaries of his experiences at the Arctic Circle, and he did, as we just heard. When the project in the Arctic came to a close, he headed to the other side of the globe, to New Zealand, without missing a beat. And that's where he's been for the past 2 years. And he's heading home to Pennsylvania shortly.
I waste my time giving myself the same speech that I want to hear.
For WVIA Art Scene, this is Derek Jolly from New Zealand, reporting my final audio journal of my 2 years living here and working as a glacier guide, creating music and learning resilience in the shadow of giants, studying safety and learning how to live on the same mountains that Sir Edmund Hillary learned, one of the first two who summited Mount Everest, and with those who knew him well. This is my final report, and I begin where I worked, Southern Alps guiding, here in our office at the Old Mountaineers Cafe.
Hey, Erica. Here I am in the Old Mountaineers Cafe bar, which also houses our guiding office for Southern Alps guiding. My boss, Charlie, owns this building, and it was opened back in 2003 by Sir Edmund Hillary. And I'm looking at the framed note that hangs on the wall here that was given to my boss and his wife, Mary, when they opened this place. It says, "To Charlie and Mary, all the best for bringing the spirit of the mountains back to Mount Cook, Ed Hillary." I'm walking out the front door, the vestibule of this beautiful cafe, situated here in the Southern Alps, to come look at the plaque that reads, "The Old Mountaineers Cafe, Restaurant, and Bar began with a dream, and with the help of good family and friends, that dream came true. Opened on July 6, 2003, by Sir Edmund Hillary for Charlie and Mary Hobbs. Dedicated to the spirit of the mountains, to the fine people who have traveled among them, and to family and friends, for the love of the mountains for the rest of life."
But with all of the history that is here, Erica, one of the things that I found ironic and very striking to me is that it's not always that simple or easy. Seems to me as though there has been a lot of pain here. There has been a lot that has shaped the type of people that can summit mountains, and I channeled that into my music. But it wasn't all sad. I really did love my job working as a glacier kayaker, and that was my favorite part of my job, was taking people out to see icebergs. I took the liberty of recording one of my briefings, and I hope that you like it.
All right, so we are on the Tasman Lake, right below Mount Cook, 3724 meters above sea level. It is the highest mountain in New Zealand. You're also looking straight ahead at the terminal face, or the 30 or 40 meter cliff of ice that is the Tasman Glacier. From here, it's about 4 kilometers away. Glaciers retreat and advance in big 10,000 to 15,000 year cycles, but it's not that smooth, right? That's the overall trend over millennia, but it has little tiny periods of warming, little tiny periods of cooling, and the last little ice age lasted from round about 1700 to 1895 when the glaciers started to retreat again. It was a very cold time on Earth. For you Americans, you might remember the story of Washington crossing the Delaware. The reason why he had to is because he was concerned that if he waited too long, the Delaware River would have frozen over and the British would have walked across it. Has anybody ever seen the Delaware River frozen solid that you could walk across, take cannons and mules and all sorts of other things?
Reenacted every Christmas, you can go still see the crossing of the Delaware.
I might get a job paddling one of the boats. That might be fun. But the reason that I wanted to bring that up is because this lake has only been around for about the last 41 years. It started retreating and forming a lake round about 1984. Unbelievable, right? When you're looking at the glacier, you notice how dirty it looks on top. The moraine walls are basically just earth that has been pushed. As the glacier advanced over millennia, it was basically like a big bulldozer, and it pushed all this earth and rock up into these big formations, which makes it inherently unstable. It's kind of like a big pile of marbles. It'll eventually just all fall apart again. So as the glacier shrinks, it's pulling down debris and rock on top of the glacier itself. Okay? So, we've talked about ice age versus warming. We've acknowledged the fact we are speeding it along. This is the quickest warming that we have recorded, and there's a lot of data to suggest that that is true. So what else is there to talk about? Does anybody want to guess how deep the Tasman Lake is? 250 meters is a good guess. Does anybody else have a guess? It's pretty consistently 300 meters deep throughout the entirety of it. Now, don't do this if you don't want to, but I'm going to invite everybody to take your hand and stick it down about 10 centimeters into the water and watch it disappear.
Oh my gosh.
Freezing, right? I love it. It feels great. It's cold. Does anybody know why this water is super cloudy? It's called rock flour. Sort of like wheat flour, but you wouldn't want to bake anything with it, okay? And it's basically just powdered mountain. So as the glacier retreats, it doesn't go at a very smooth and consistent way. It sort of serves as like a big mortar and pestle, and it grinds up all of this rock into a fine powder, and over time it mixes in, and it gives Glacier Lakes this very distinct and unique cloudy turquoise color. Probably the last water in the world that doesn't have microplastics in it. You can't fool nature, you can't fool animals. So as the climate changes incrementally, so does everything else. And that's why I guide this tour as an eco tour and as a scenic home tour, because you're looking at something that we're gonna blink our eyes and it's gonna be gone. And this lake is different every 5 minutes. It could be different 5 minutes from now. We could be looking there and a giant bunch of ice just falls off the face. Let's see if I can get it to do it. Ready, go. Nope. I've been out here when half the face falls off and I'm like, okay, woo. Which in that case, we go to the middle of the lake and we just kind of ride it out. It's fun. Yeah, as long as we stay safe. But every single time a little bit of ice falls off, it's because it's retreating. It's just alarming how quickly it moves. Lots of ice. All good?
Yep.
Sweet. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk. How about we get a little bit more paddling in?
As you just heard, I do try to incorporate my American identity into my tours, even 10,000 miles away from home. And as much as I like to do that as a guide, I've also had the chance to speak about our experience and the type of music I'm writing on the radio. I visited Wellington and performed live on the radio, and here's what I said. This song is my genuine hope that us Americans can do better, and it's called Collection of Ghosts. Definitely was not the only place that I found my American identity sticking out in New Zealand. At one stage, I made it to a party that was being thrown for Christmas, and Christmas in the Southern Hemisphere hits a little bit like the 4th of July back home because it happens in the middle of the summer in New Zealand. So I found myself at a sheep shearing shed, and I wanted to share that with you too.
Hey, Erica. I'm at a party in a shearing shed, like a sheep shearing shed. The theme is bright and tight. It's really hot outside, but it's the Christmas party, and there's a band about to play. I just figured this might be an interesting little piece, so I wanted to share that this is what I'm doing right now. It's not all glaciers, but still, it makes me miss my barn parties in Northeast Pennsylvania where my band cut our teeth. So. An interesting perspective, 10,000 miles away from home. All right, that's enough for that.
Observing so much contrast while living in New Zealand as an American, it inspired me to look for ways to figure out the cosmopolitan differences between our two societies, what it means to grow up a Kiwi, what it means to grow up an American. To this end, I asked my boss, Charlie, my chief guide, if I could sit down with him and ask him some questions, and he gave me an interview.
Thank you, Charlie. For the American listeners back home, I'm going to ask you a series of questions. First, what is your name and where are you from?
Charles Hobbs. Charlie.
And
I'm from Araki, Mount Cook.
In New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
What is your profession?
Oh, I'm an internationally recognized mountain and ski guide.
And how long have you been doing that?
Gosh. Well, I must have been very young when I started. Get the calculator out and work that one out. So what'll be in now? 2026?
Yeah.
Take away 1985. 41 years.
Mountain ski guide for 41 years.
Yeah.
Wow.
And probably climbing and skiing for, oh my gosh, 52 years.
52 years.
So, wow. how can I be that old?
I've seen the field every day, Charlie. You don't look old to me. How old were you the first time that you summited Araki?
In my 20s.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you had to guess, how many summits do you think that you've made?
29.
29? How old were you when you stopped?
I was in my 50s.
Okay.
When I stopped when you climbing stopped. Cook.
Mm-hmm. Do you miss it?
No.
Leave that to the young guys.
Yeah. So. I mean, look, it's all relevant to, you know, what you enjoy doing. Anything big is demanding and can be difficult. You know, big days. So, you know, one has to look at sustainability in life.
What's your favorite activity to do now when you're guiding?
Well, that all depends on what the weather's doing.
Good point.
I mean, who wouldn't love a four-run heli-ski day in beautiful, light, fluffy powder?
Yeah, good point. How do you know me? How do you know Derek?
Well, Derek replied to an ad calling for a glacier guide, and I talked to him on the phone, and he, you know, sounded like an okay sort of guy.
I would hope so, yeah.
So I gave him the job on the phone.
Now that I'm in my second season with you, Charlie, you think you made a good call in hiring me?
Oh, regret it every day. No, it's been a good call. Unfortunately, you know, your time's coming to an end, which is a bit sad because would have been good to have you carry on, but you know, needs must.
Absolutely, yeah. What drew you to guiding? What made you want to be a guide?
Well, at first, I never wanted to be a guide.
Really?
No. Okay. I was a young climber, you know, free, loose, fancy, free, roaming the mountains, climbing peaks, you know. And then I started doing courses, running courses for mountain safety and Alpine Club and getting involved. And I found that I really liked it. You know, as I got a little bit older, I thought, hey, I'm spending so much time in the mountains. Maybe I could make money out of it.
There you go.
So I did. I decided I'd do the guides exams because, you know, I'd been mountaineering for a while and I was quite proficient.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, there you go. Never look back, huh?
Never look back. But doing the guide certification enabled me to work overseas or get jobs with Uncle Sam.
What was your job with Uncle Sam?
Oh, well, I was guiding scientists in the Antarctic. And I did that for 5 seasons. I wouldn't have got that if I hadn't taken that guiding step. You know, guiding overseas expeditions with, you know, people like Rob Hall and Gary Ball.
You know my background working in science in the deep field. That always has spoke to me, your experience with that.
Mm.
You know, applying what you love to a wider field.
Yeah.
We're very alike in that way, and I appreciate that.
I have my name on a science paper too. Third author.
Yeah, well, there you go. I'll have to read that paper.
Yeah.
I would love to. And you got your name on a couple first summits and passes in Antarctica, right? We got the Hobbs
Pass. We did, yeah. I don't think I'll be going back there again, though.
I'll go there for you. Anybody that comes into your cafe, this beautiful cafe you built, will see the plaque outside. We'll see the letters and everything that you have up on the wall. That one, Sir Ed came here in 2003 to open the cafe. So I'm interested to ask, how do you know Sir Ed?
Well, Mary and I published a magazine called New Zealand Outside. And Sir Edmund Hillary really liked it. And he liked the way Mary wrote. And he loved photos she took. And he actually endorsed the magazine for Mary. Always wrote a nice comment in there. We would visit him quite a lot at his Auckland home, and we created a friendship with him. And yeah, he really liked Mary, you know. You know, and then he invited us to Nepal with him a couple of times to join him on his fundraising projects that he does for the schools and for the Nepalese kids and whatever. Look, if anything, that was more amazing than, you know, climbing a mountain or, you know, just seeing how they treated him and revered him. That was pretty special. He was a great Kiwi.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're a great Kiwi, so you're speaking on behalf of your kind. I know that Sir Ed passed away in 2008. I remember reading in your book, Charlie, that when he passed away, you made an honorary summit of Mount Olivier in his honor. When I moved here and became a guide, my first summit was Olivier as well. I just think that's really meaningful.
Well, it's one of the first things he did, wasn't it?
Forgive me if I'm wrong, but I believe that your cafe and our guiding office here was the only building that he grand opened in the park,
it
right?
Totally is.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, it's the only business that he officially cut the red tape life on.
You know, when I'm here by myself getting everything ready in the morning, sometimes I can imagine that he's looking over my shoulder.
I mean, I just remember Ed as a humble guy who wanted to help people. You know, he didn't want to be famous.
Yeah.
But he was the first, and he used his great position to help people. It didn't make him a rich man. He used his fame to help, and I take my hat off to him for that, you know. And I think that's something we need to keep installing into younger people.
Speaking as an American, I feel very similarly, you know. I'm inspired by the people that I look up to.
Yeah, you know, like mentoring young guides and meet them on the glacier, shake the hand, teach them how to maintain that tradition of watching out for one another rather than just being competitive and, you know, dog eat dog. And
yeah, so you reject that kind of mentality then?
Yeah, you've got to keep it alive.
Because when you're out there, you only got each other.
That's right.
I have one more question for you, Charlie. Ooh. What matters to you? That's a big question, but what's the most meaningful thing to you? What matters to you most in life?
Honor and integrity. Because if you don't have that, you have nothing.
I'm not surprised to hear you say that, because that's what you've been teaching me this whole time.
Yeah. If you don't have that, what's left? Because if you have that, then everything falls into place, doesn't it?
Indeed.
Yeah.
Do you have anything that you would like to add?
We're a breed.
We're out here. It's you've showed me a different side of professionalism, that you can get up every day, do what you love, and still earn and still learn. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Good. All right. I think that's pretty good for us.
There you go.
And unfortunately, one of the important lessons I learned from working with Charlie was how to deal with loss. And I channeled that into my music as well.
Our life is sacred, even mine, even yours. Find a sympathetic way to ease the pain. Kill nothing, even if you're forced.
But more important than dealing with loss is learning how to prevent it. And that was one of the most important skills that I gained while working as a glacier guide. I shared a little bit of my time actually up on the ice. And there's practically only one real way to get there on a given day for a tour like we would guide, and that's by helicopter.
Hey Erica, this is Derek. From the white ice of the Tasman Glacier. It is a beautiful day, right in the middle of summer, December 14th, 2025. And I am cutting my way out of an ice cave that I'm trying to make safe for our clients on our heli hike. So, give a few more swings of my axe. That's enough of a stair for me to get up. Probably hear my crampons in the ice. It is a beautiful day here. Like I said, I'm here emerging from this ice cave on the Tasman Glacier, and I can't help but think back to what Ed Hillary must have thought in the beginning of the 20th century when he was training for his Everest expedition here. What an unbelievably beautiful place this is. This landscape is quickly disappearing. We will blink our eyes and this will be gone, or it would have changed. Be incredibly different. But I just wanted to say hello, and now is time for me to cut my way out of this ice cave to rejoin my fellow guides. And just like that, I'm free. Freer than I've ever felt, Erica. This is Derek Jolly from the Tasman Glacier, signing off for now. I have found my clients down here in the ice cave, and I'm on my way to them now. Let's see what they think.
Hey, it's Charlie.
Hey, Derek.
How you going?
Good. Derek, you can go down behind me.
Real nice and easy, okay?
So, John and Josephine, a little bit of a different vibe than Yonkers, huh? You ever think you'd be under glacier ice in an ice cave? I know New York can get cold, but it can't get glacier ice. Here we are exiting this beautiful ice cave. The roar of the slowly melting glacier is going to fade away as we go back out into the sun. There we are, Erica. Out of the cave, back into the light.
So I keep asking myself, what does this all mean? What was the context of this great adventure that I've had over these past 2 years? What was the point? I think it's going to take me a very long time to actually fully understand what I learned here. But I think I did the right work as to setting myself up to realize that. Music has always been an emotional journal for me. I can remember exactly how I felt when I listened to a song that I recorded, much more than how I would read an old page from a journal or whatever. I think it's important that I took the time to actually make this, and I appreciate that you have asked me to create these audio journals from my time living here. And as I start my sojourn back to the United States, back to my home state of Pennsylvania, to rejoin my people, I can't help but feel that I've been changed by this. I'm different now. It might take me a while to figure out exactly how, but I'm different. More importantly, I feel like I'm more myself than I ever have been, as cliche as that might sound. And I appreciate you giving me the chance to process this out. One of the things I realize now is that music is the way that I interpret my own growth. And now I'm doing it from a flipped perspective, having lived on the other side of the world for so long. I hope I go back someday, but I have a lot more growing to do at home first. Erica, I can't thank you enough, and to all of the listeners for WVIA Art Scene Back Home. This is Derek Jolly from the flip side of the globe, signing off for the last time for now. Cheers.
What's the meaning of a meaningful life? We all keep talking and no one's listening. What's the meaning of a meaningful life? We all keep marching to the beat of the same drum.
Derek Jolly, adventurer, mountain and glacier guide, kayaker, musician, native of northeastern Pennsylvania, offering the final installment of his audio diaries from New Zealand. His two-year sojourn is winding up, and he'll be back in Pennsylvania very shortly. And as we heard, what does this all mean? He asked at the end of that sojourn. He asked his boss, Charlie Hobbs, what means the most to you? Integrity and honor were the words Charlie used. And we think that probably Derek Jolly will hold to those two key values throughout his life. For more information about Derek Jolly and his music, you can check the website cuddledrug.com, cuddledrug.com, and the name has to do with oxytocin, the substance that's released in the brain to make one feel a sense of well-being, and he would like to, in his life, do the kind of work that will bring well-being to the many and to everyone he meets. Bon voyage, Derek Jolly.